Welcome to the XYZ Experiment podcast. Today we're talking to Sammy and we're going to talk about artificial intelligence. Welcome to the podcast, Sammy.
Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's a pleasure, and it's Fiona and Dash here. Sammy, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a computer scientist by training turned sort of humanist.
What do you mean by humanist?
Well, technology never exists in a vacuum, right?
Yeah.
And even though like my roots are in technology, I forget what law it was that technology is not good or bad, nor is it neutral. Kranzberg's laws of technology, that's right. And, you know, it always has an impact to society in one way or another. And how we interface with technology will shape society.
Yeah.
And that technology, you know, has certain impacts, and we need to take that into account when we build that technology.
So you bring the humanist lens when you're thinking about, like, the human lens.
Well, I try to anyway.
Yeah. Like that.
And what brought you to Australia?
Not to use the term flippantly, I'm a climate refugee.
Okay.
So I was never compatible with the Finnish winters.
And
not so much the darkness, but the darkness.
Yeah.
You don't see the sun for a good part of the year. However, it extends a little bit broader than that. So Finland is a country of one official truth. So there's one way of doing things, and if you kind of step outside those bounds, you're frowned upon. And I was never really comfortable with that. So it's the business and cultural climate as well.
And what made you choose Australia?
Oh, that was an embarrassing Excel-based exercise of picking a country where my wife and I wouldn't have to learn a new language.
Yes.
And that kind of limited.
Has Australia sort of met your expectations? If you sort of did your spreadsheet, has it met those expectations?
Well, the spreadsheet didn't have expectations on it. So I tried to come here with moderately low expectations.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, this is home now. So yes. From that perspective, yes, it has.
Yeah.
Wow.
Or exceeding.
Yeah. And you come to Melbourne, we don't have as much sun as, say, Queensland or
well, yeah,
Perth
but
or
yeah, so
it's
when
such a great city.
Whenever people hear that I kind of moved here partially because of the climate, they are like, well, what the fuck did you move to Melbourne then?
But
everything's relative, right?
Yeah. Yes.
My favorite piece of statistics is that Helsinki, which is like the sunniest part of the country, in the month of December has an average of 8 hours of sunlight over the month.
The whole month.
50 minutes a day on average.
So we do ask all of our guests to tell us which generation they belong to.
Well, so I'm not a fan of any categorization like that. I guess technically Gen X. A couple of my friends have called me a zillennial.
Yes.
So I don't know what that tells you. I don't like any kind of boxes that we put people into. Yeah, so I don't subscribe to that notion, but yeah.
So when you say some of your friends call you
a zillennial.
What do you think they're getting at then with that? What are they observing of you?
Well, I try to take the charitable interpretation that I don't come across as old school as millennials do.
So true.
That's pretty good. Because we do ask, you know, what is the most Gen X thing about you? Do you feel there's anything that is a Gen X characterization, even though you don't like being put in a box, which I totally get?
I would say that a healthy disrespect to authority and kind of trying to look a little bit deeper and be a little bit skeptical about things.
Tell us a little bit about your work in AI.
So I'm a computer scientist by training, as I mentioned. So kind of AI has been on the radar for 30 years for me. Of course, a lot of the earlier stages, it was different kinds of AI. We had expert systems and things like that. Then over the past 10 years, it got into some of the more machine learning pattern recognition type of AI. I was at Telstra 10 years ago when the Australian federal government decided that Australia needs its own ethical AI framework or responsible AI principles. Why? I don't know, because there were literally 100 of them in the world at that point in time. Could just copy one.
Mm.
But no, we didn't our own. So, you know, Telstra worked with the federal government in trialing that framework and things like that. So that's kind of a decade ago. It took a larger part of my working life. And for many years, that was sort of the pattern recognition side of AI. And then, you know, a couple of years ago, you may have heard of ChatGPT and the likes. So when they came on board, you know, the generative AI thing became a much bigger part of my professional life.
And how did you get, like, what made you start working in AI specifically?
Well, it's an exciting space for one.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. You know, it's a lot of powerful technologies, a lot of powerful tools, both in the pattern recognition side. So, you know, which I sometimes uncharitably call the legacy AI, not to mean that they're not important systems that we need to have, you know, operating in the future as well. But particularly the generative AI side. So backtrack a little bit. One of the other major hats that I wear is strategic foresight. So helping organizations think about the long term in a little bit more structured and mindful manner. And from that side, generative AI kind of started progressing so rapidly that it became pretty much impossible for an organization to have anything approaching like a five-year AI strategy. And part of that then tied into the foresight work, because it became really hard to do like a 10-year strategy or a 10-year vision for an organization working in the technology space when the generative AI thing just started changing everything. So I felt like I needed to come, while still wearing the foresight hat, I needed to come more to today and, you know, help organizations how to deal with this entirely new beast today. Like, not in terms of let's create a 5-year, 10 AI strategy, but like, how do we think about it today? What do we do with it today? How do we tackle it today?
It's almost hard to keep up with because it's so vertical.
It's literally the way it's going. It's literally impossible to keep up with.
Yeah.
So I've just given up on keeping up with it from like an objective point of view.
Yeah.
I still try, but it gives me a little bit of peace that there is just so much going on that it's impossible for any one person to keep on top of everything.
So I guess, you know, going into that space, how does one learn AI and all of the components, I guess, around it? Or is that just an impossible task?
Well, I guess two-part answer to that question. So I have a computer science background, and so, you know, I have ability to learn the technical side of things.
Yeah.
However, like, there is no one person on the planet who knows how, you know, ChatGPT works, like how all of it works. Like, no one person will be able to tell you everything about it.
Wow.
And this is not new. Like, there is no one person on the planet who'll be able to tell everything your piece of shit Windows desktop does.
Okay.
So these technologies are so complicated and so complex. No, there is no one person who understands everything.
Yeah.
So there is that. But another point is that while it's possible to learn the technological principles and the underpinnings of the technology and, you know, sort of the broad strokes of how it works, how it does, I don't think that's important. I don't think it's necessary. For the vast majority of people, you don't need to know how something works to be able to use it effectively.
Yeah.
So what I like to use, like, the bicycle analogy.
Mm-hmm.
We don't. There was a famous research from Rebecca Lawson from University of Liverpool, I think, on the illusion of explanatory depth. So she talked to 20 years ago or so, just regular people, like, asked them about their level of understanding of everyday technologies, like bicycles. Like, do you know how a bicycle works? And most people will be like, duh, yeah, of course I know. Of course I know how a bicycle works. What kind of question is that? But then she asked them to sketch a bicycle, like a diagram of a bicycle, without actually seeing a bicycle. And most people were unable to produce anything resembling a mechanically accurate bicycle.
Yeah.
So they just had the illusion of knowing how a bicycle works. And still, it would be a fair assumption to say that most people know how to ride a bicycle. So you don't even need to know how a bicycle works in order to use that. And given that generative AI is like many, many orders of magnitude more complex than a bicycle, it's really hard to try to understand the underlying technology. I mean, you literally spend years of effort into getting like pretty good understanding of it. And for most people, I mean, most people don't have the time, but it's not important.
Yeah.
So, well, I argue it's not important. You don't need to understand the technology in great detail to be able to use it effectively.
So I guess on that note, okay, so we're taking away, for the majority of us, we don't need to necessarily understand it, but maybe to take a step back, can you explain to us what is, like, you've used the word generative AI in simple terms?
I'm going to explain it through my favorite metaphor. So this metaphor comes from Ethan Mollick, who has said that generative AI should be thought of as an intern. So you can think of generative AI, you know, ChatGPT or the likes, as a highly intelligent, fresh out of university, very eager to help you, but with no real world experience in turn. And that'll kind of tell you how you should talk to it, how you should behave, how you should use it. And it'll also tell you kind of intuitively that you shouldn't really like trust it.
Yeah.
Not completely. Like nobody in a business world would put an intern in charge of their call center, for example.
So it has a place, but you wouldn't want it to lead.
No, not in the current evolution of technology anyway.
I use it heaps, right? Like I use versions of ChatGPT that our sector allows us to use. But one of the things that I'm realizing, it is being trained on who I am. So like the prompts I put in and the way that I ask it, it will spit out. It's like it knows what I want it to tell me back. And my staff members can, you know, do very similar things. They might use different prompts. So we almost, like, how it came up is I was like, you didn't use Microsoft Copilot when you were, like, checking your grammar and your sentence and, like, making this in more lay. And they were like, yes, I did. And then I used it and it came up with different responses. And it was because I think it knows me in a different way. Is that fair to say?
It's fair to say that many of the large language models kind of start to know you, yes. So Copilot is not really a great tool.
No, but that's the one I'm allowed to use, Sammy.
Yes. So, you know, ChatGPT, for example, it now has a memory feature, so it'll start remembering things about you, or you can tell it to remember stuff, and then it will, you know, adjust its behavior and responses accordingly. So, yeah, it does. They do increasingly start to know you as you use them.
Wow.
But that doesn't mean that you couldn't prompt them in a certain way and have them behave completely differently.
Yeah.
Because sometimes when I'm using ChatGPT, I'm asking it some things I want to do, and then my husband's standing next to me going, he then tells me like a different question to ask it or a different way to frame it, and then it comes up with more with what I want. It's always about what are you... I get the feeling it's very important what you tell it or ask it for what you're going to get back. Would that be correct? Like,
yes.
That's really important.
Yeah. I mean, there people talk about prompt engineering, and there are like entire actual jobs about prompt engineering.
Yeah.
I don't think you necessarily have to go into that level of depth in that,
yeah.
but how you prompt kind of is important.
Yeah.
On the other hand, so there are some strategies on what you can do to make your prompts better, make it behave better. I think the underlying principle is that if you don't get immediately what you want out of the model, so if it's not good enough or if it does something you don't want it to do, don't assume that you have hereby discovered the limitations of the model.
Yes.
Assume that you're prompting it wrong and try again.
I thought I was the limit because I was asking it for a title to a podcast episode. Mm. So, and I asked for 5 examples and I'm reading them out to my husband and going, oh, it's not great. And he goes, put the word clickbait in there, see what you get now. And then it was great. It's just needed a different prompt. Just needed a different prompt of what I was asking it. So,
using generative AI for ideation is great.
Yeah.
You know, people talk about how the models hallucinate and like make up stuff. They don't know what's true and what's not. I mean, that's accurate. But what is ideation except making up stuff, right? So it's like, it's perfect for that. Now, are the ideas always awesome? No.
No.
But the cost of kind of wrong ideas in ideation is fairly low.
Yeah.
So in my experience, whenever I use some AI tool for ideation, I find like 80% of the responses are like, okay. 15% are like, well, that's actually quite good.
Yeah.
And maybe 5% are like, I wouldn't have thought of that myself.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So when I think of AI, and I think a lot of people, we're talking about ChatGPT, but where is AI in our everyday life? Like people probably don't realize how much AI is even within our lives. Like where are we seeing it?
Yeah, I mean, we all use AI to a degree without knowing it.
Yeah.
And the vast majority of that would be sort of the pattern recognition AI, the past kind of AI. Well, not the past, but, you know, the other style of model. So not generative AI. There is a pattern recognition AI, and then there is pattern generation AI. So this kind of AI that's been around for, you know, good 10 years in widespread commercial use, even longer than that, is the pattern recognition one. And that we use all the time. So whenever we talk to, you know, Siri or Alexa or Google Now or whatever, that's AI. Whatever we search photos, that's AI. Whatever we use social media, we kind of subject it to the recommendation algorithms of the platform, which is also AI, and so on and so on. And it's kind of embodies the phrase that the most important technologies kind of disappear. So we don't think about them anymore.
Yeah. So we're not conscious of it because it's just there. Like I know my Google Maps knows my routine because it will automatically say, oh, you're heading to this place now because that's where I go at 8 o'clock on a Saturday afternoon, for example. I'm like, whoa.
Like on one hand, it's very powerful that these systems kind of disappear from view and they just become part of everything. So it makes for a smoother user experience. You don't need to put in your location to Google Maps or whatever when it just knows where you're going. But on the other hand, it makes it a little bit more dangerous because they are still biased and imperfect systems. So then we don't see, you know, the suboptimal performance or suboptimal things that they do under the surface either.
So what would be an example of that?
Well, recommendation algorithms are a great example of that. I mean, we know social media platforms, by and large, optimize engagement. And the best way to get engagement is rage.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, if you try to get an emotionally arousing content, you know, that tends to engage people. But then you can easily see where that goes.
Yeah.
Like if and when the target of the platform is to keep you engaged on the platform, and the easiest way to engage a human is through negative emotions or, you know, emotions with a negative valence, then bad things will happen.
Is that because it's learning that's what you want to hear, or earlier?
Yeah. I mean, partially it's learning from the individual users, but partially it's also learning from just, you know, humanity on average.
Okay. And what it's seeing coming up in the world and things like that. Like, is it accessing all of the internet and seeing what people are putting up and all that sort of stuff? Or?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's probably an oversimplification.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, it depends on the platform, how they work as well. But when you think of the social media platforms, the vast majority of them are advertising driven.
Yeah.
So, you know, the more time you spend on the platform, the more money they get, and then that becomes their metric.
Because I've got this thought in my head about that. Am I teaching the AI or is the AI teaching me? Like, am I teaching the AI through my anger and aggression to show me more of this? Or is the AI going, oh, I see a little bit of this in you, so I'm just going to show you more and more and more of it?
Well, yes.
Okay.
So, I mean, there is the phrase that we shape our tools and thereafter our tools shape us.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, both are happening.
Yeah. Yesterday I was sitting down to lunch and two of the girls were talking about some sort of shop product that they wanted to buy, and then literally 5 minutes later one of them's freaking out because all of a sudden her Facebook or whatever starts suggesting all different and she was just like, oh my god, it's listening to me, and like really having a freak out about it.
Yeah. That's been a pervasive, I wouldn't say a partial myth. I mean, sometimes yes, there's been some evidence that, you know, they might listen, you know, to you or whatever. I don't really think that they actually listen to you. I mean, you can turn off the microphone in the settings for the app and then it won't listen to you. But I think the experience of seeing something that you recently kind of engaged with come back to you,
it might
be just kind of like maybe we humans are just pretty predictable.
Okay. What are some of the most exciting and beneficial things of AI happening at the moment?
That's a real good question. So if we're talking about generative AI in particular, it holds a lot of promise in sort of helping humans do stuff.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of focus on human replacement because efficiency, you know, we have a capitalistic system. Most organizations strive for efficiencies, right? So whenever there is a new technological capability in the present sort of capitalist system, neoliberal capitalism system, there's like two main approaches for that. An organization can do the same that they're doing today, but with fewer, usually human resources. So let people go.
Yeah.
Or they can do more with the resources they have. And like, you know, I'll leave it as an exercise to the listeners on how that split goes, how many companies think of, you know, option one versus option B. But I'll say that if all organizations, we're only thinking about let's do more with what we have with these new tools, we wouldn't be talking about, you know, job threats to employment or threats to job or anything like that. So it's really, you know, from my point of view, it's a lack of imagination that we're potentially looking at some pretty negative consequences from all of this. Mm-hmm. Like, I think an AI tool or AI tools are brilliant as creative help or as decision assistance or for, you know, helping you with stuff. But we shouldn't delegate stuff to them.
So we're using it to make our workforce better, not to replace our workforce.
Well, we should use it like that. Are we? Like, So to illustrate, a lot depends on who is using that technology. So if you consider, say, whether it's ChatGPT or Claude or whatever have you, you have an AI tool to help you write articles, right? Mm. Like if you use it as an individual, say, reporter, you're probably going to be able to, you know, work a little bit faster, produce better quality, and enjoy the process more.
Yeah.
If you use it, like, as a tool for you as an individual. The end result would be that you enjoy your job a little bit more, you get better quality results in a little bit faster time, and, you know, you might have less stress in your job, given that, you know, some of the pressure is taken off.
Mm-hmm.
The very same tool, if it's deployed by the organization in, like, a top-down manner, the management decides that, hey, we have this AI tool for writing articles now, everybody needs to use it for this, and that becomes a mandate, they will most likely drive it with an efficiency mindset.
Yeah.
So they'll, you know, given that demonstrably people can achieve a little bit more, they'll let go a couple of people, and the remaining workforce will be under more pressure than they were before.
Okay.
Yeah. With the same tool.
Yeah.
So depending on how you deploy the tools, the consequences will be dramatically different.
So is this an example of, like, you applying a humanistic approach?
Yes. And, like, one of the things that I do when I work with organizations is always ask people, like, well, what are the things that you would most want to automate from your day-to-day life? Everybody's dealing with all kinds of annoying stuff in their, you know, day-to-day life. And, you know, these are the things that they would want to automate. And then on the other hand, I ask, like, well, what are the most fulfilling things that you find about your job? What provide you meaning and purpose? What don't you want to automate? So these two lists, like, there is one and only one sort of standard answer that everybody gives. So nobody, not that I've come across anyway, nobody wants to automate the human-to-human interaction. So dealing with stakeholders or, you know, your colleagues, having face-to-face discussions, building engagement, building rapport, nobody wants to automate that. Mm-hmm. But after that, it depends.
Yeah.
So maybe half the people say that, I really want to automate all writing. I hate writing emails. I hate writing reports. I hate doing presentations. I want that all automated. And then the other half is like, I love writing. Writing is what I do. Writing is how I, you know, writing is my purpose. And that kind of talks to the deployment of the tools.
Yeah.
So if you allow people to use these tools as individuals and use them for what they think they're going to benefit from, on what they want to automate, what they want help in, that'll make their lives easier. It'll make their, you know, job satisfaction much better because they can then automate some of the annoying things. But if you have an organizational edict, like, we are now going to use this and this tool for writing, and that's the rule, well, half of the people are going to be happy and half are going to be pissed off.
Yeah.
Because that's an interesting question about what do you want to use AI for? Because when you're talking just then, I'm thinking, well, I want to use AI to make myself more creative.
Right.
Whereas, like, when I listen to you, Dash, I'm thinking you want AI to help you get more time back in the day.
A little bit. But, you know, sometimes, like, I know, being an academic, I've been trained to write in a particular way, right, to write in a very scientific, boring way. And so, but the audience now of impact for academic outputs is changing. So they say, now you have to write for industry or you have to write for the public. We weren't trained in that. So my prompt into AI is I still put the content in there and then I say, make this jazzier is my new favorite prompt. make this sound more compelling, right? Because, and then I have to re-edit it because sometimes it gets too excited and I'm like, calm down, that's not actually, now you've stretched the truth of what I put in there. But I actually enjoy that. Like, I enjoy that, what it spits back out to me and going, oh, yeah, that's right, no, that's not right, or, you know, that kind of stuff. But I wouldn't want it to have taken away my writing creative bit first, even though it was scientific and boring in the first instance.
And, like, that point, what you just mentioned, probably brings out the biggest thing to keep in mind. You need to use these tools within your domain of expertise.
Yes.
Yeah. Because they are very fluent bullshitters.
Yeah.
So they, you know, and if you are not an expert in whatever you're using it in, you won't be able to spot the mistakes. And there will be mistakes.
100%. There are mistakes. And you just sit there and you go, you've just changed a word slightly and that actually means a whole different thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is interesting. But I think emails definitely, like I often put emails through and say, make this sound more polite, friendlier, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I do use it for that too, like low value tasks that I want to say no to something, but, you know, maybe say politely.
Yeah.
And I couldn't be bothered thinking about that for 5 minutes.
Yes, exactly. It's really good for that.
I'm reading a novel at the moment. It's a new one by Richard Osman. And it's the first time I've ever seen them talking about ChatGPT in a book, first time. And it's the villain. And the villain is saying to ChatGPT, send this email, but make me sound like an English dandy man. And then all the emails go out like that to try and hide who they are. Like, but it's the first time I've ever heard it in a book. And I thought, oh, that's what people must be doing. They must be going, send this email out so I sound like an Aussie woman, or you know what I mean? Like, you can actually hide your personality behind it as well, I suppose.
You can. Yeah. You can use it, you know, the same feature can obviously use for anything else as well, including positive things. So, you know, a lot of corporations have certain material that they need to present to a wide variety of stakeholders in a slightly different wording or a slightly different format or a slightly different whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's great for that.
Yeah.
If you have one source material and you just recut it to different audiences in a little bit of a different way.
Yeah.
The, a lot of the AI, again, we're talking about is very interactive. And where is AI not so interactive that it's happening behind the scenes and I'm not even interacting with it and don't realize? Is there any sort of AI like that as well?
Well, there's a whole lot of AI that we talked previously that's kind of underneath the surface that's doing decisions or decision support that we don't really necessarily interact with on a daily basis.
Who sets the rules up for that? Is that someone who's created that? Or
good question, happens? Right?
Yeah.
So we have, as I mentioned earlier, we now have hundreds of sort of ethical AI frameworks out there. They're all voluntary. Who controls whether something is being done ethically? Nobody.
Yeah.
Okay. It's up to the organization that's deploying it or the government department or whatever. And, of course, we saw, like, it'd be too charitable to call the RoboDebt scandal AI because that was just, you know, stupid script. But you can see the principle. There were clearly no effective ethical principles in that process.
Yeah.
And it resulted in, you know, terrible consequences.
Yeah.
And the same thing applies to more complex systems. Unless you have an effective ethical control of it, then it can start doing really bad things without necessarily anybody seeing.
Has there been cases yet where AI has broken the law?
What do you mean breaking
the law? Well, you know, like I just think cases where they may have adopted the voice or image of someone else to put a message out there, like that would be typically considered almost fraud, right?
So, well, I want to say yes with a caveat. So AI doesn't know the truth. It doesn't know what's right. It doesn't know what's wrong. It basically does what you want it to do. And have people used AI to make unlawful content and unlawful things? Yeah, absolutely. All the time. Like, deepfakes are a great example of that. And lots of damage is being caused by deepfakes.
Because it's got to the point now where I think I'm correct in saying this, that you can't use some video and photos and that in court anymore because they just don't know whether it's true or not.
Yeah, so this is this is one of the biggest challenges, right? So we know that generative AI tools can be used to create extremely realistic videos, photos, any media for that matter. So that's creating a bit of an epistemological crisis in the world. So it's not just that it's easy to put fake stuff out there or that it's difficult to tell whether something's real or not. It's that we don't then necessarily believe anything is real anymore.
Yeah.
So the plausible deniability of somebody saying that, well, I didn't say that, that's fake.
And we're seeing that heaps, that people are like, that was a fake account, that wasn't me, that, and you can't go back and say, oh yeah, that's true or not. How much does it get back traced back to the person?
Well, it's really difficult, right? Like, Adobe started this content authenticity initiative, which is trying to come up with solutions for this so that there would be some way of when you take a photo or when you take a video to sort of prove with digital signatures that this is actually something that happened.
Yeah.
That this is an authentic photograph, this is an authentic video. Yes, the government official actually said that, but those systems are not really in widespread deployment yet.
Oh.
So I don't think we will never have tools that will conclusively be able to tell whether a piece of content is authentic or not. I don't think so.
Oh, this that's is like, so depressing.
This is like a cat and mouse game. However, I do believe we will have in the future, and you know, to extend today, some of the content that has been verified authentic. So when the whole chain is integrated, you can tell whether, you know, content that's specifically made with a certain kind of equipment, with certain software, you can verify that it's authentic. But that's, you know, so far a very small percentage of content, if any, for all practical purposes. Mm-hmm. But for any particular random image out there on the internet, it's practically impossible to verify its authenticity.
Because I've seen two examples of that this week. One was in response to Kanye West T-shirts that he was selling. Someone did an ad for the Jewish community using famous actors and figures with a T-shirt on, but it's not actually them at all. Yeah. And it's only because one of the actors spoke up, which was Scarlett Johansson, and said, that's not me in that. And she's horrified, not as in horrified, but it's just like, it looks so much like her. And she was saying, it's not me. That's actually not me in that ad. Like, I didn't know anything about it. And I'm shocked to see my face there. You know, so that was one, because people thought that was real.
I thought that was real.
Yeah, no, it's not real at all. And then the another one I heard was a radio announcer in Melbourne radio here. He was saying that he heard an ad recently and AI had used his voice for the ad. They had gotten it off the radio because he's spoken enough on radio that then they could do the ad with his voice.
Yes, and voice cloning can now be done from like seconds of audio.
He was stunned.
So anybody who's out there as a public persona, their voices can be cloned really easily.
So they were selling a product that he had no knowledge of, and I think that happens a lot when people get those conned, you know. They say that such and such is supporting this and you hear them speak and there's a video of them and it's not until they come out and go, oh, God, that's not me. Like, it's incredible. Just incredible.
Those phone calls, like kids calling their parents saying they're in trouble. Yeah.
So this is, you know, those kind of scams. Like, we urgently need an awareness that families need to basically have two-factor authentication.
Yeah.
So like within your family group or whatever, have a challenge word, have like something that you say and you respond with a certain word to actually verify that it is you who you're talking to. Because right now, when like a grandma gets a call from her daughter in distress, she won't be able to tell whether it's her daughter or granddaughter or not.
And you're saying we don't yet have the frameworks or the legal systems to, like, deal with this yet.
Well, not only don't we have a legal system, but we don't have, like, the family system. So we need, like, rules within families. Like, we need to have a challenge work. We need to have two-factor authentication. Like, how do I know I'm talking to you?
To you.
And then this will – I shouldn't make predictions because foresight professionals don't make predictions. We give like plausible futures, but I will make a prediction that within a year or so let's say by the end of 2026, you will not be able to tell whether you are talking on a Zoom call or a Teams call, the real person or not. It could be, you know, a digital twin,
yeah,
an authorized digital twin. So, you know, say a situation where there's a boring meeting, I don't want to go, I'll send my AI twin and he'll take care of it. And people won't be able to tell the difference. So that's bad. But where it gets worse, it could be an unauthorized digital twin as well. So it could be somebody masquerading as you. And the other parties would not be able to tell.
It's a bit like, can I book an interview with you on Zoom? And you think, oh, it's that person. Great. Yeah, let's have a chat. And it's not even that person at all.
That's right.
Wow.
And like I have my personal hypothesis is that give it a couple of years and that will result in a sort of a renewed interest in business travel when organizations realize that all critical decisions, all meetings where critical decisions are being made need to be had face-to-face.
Yes.
Because we can't trust the online versions.
Yeah. Wow. So how do different generations perceive and use AI?
I don't think that it's as much about sort of generational divides, but more cognitive divides, like how you think about the technologies, how you think about the tools that you're using or don't, as it may be. But at the same time, I am reminded of Douglas Adams's rules of technology. I don't know if people heard about them. So, you know, Douglas Adams had these rules of technology where he said that anything that is in the world when you're born is normal and ordinary and just a natural part of how the world works. Anything that's invented between when you're 15 and 35 is new and exciting, and you can probably make a career out of it. And anything that's invented after you're 35 is against the natural order of things.
Yeah.
So in that sense, you know, maybe there is some kind of a generational divide as well. The side that I'm more worried about, I think longer term, is education.
Okay. Yeah.
So like we talked earlier, you need to be at their current point in evolution anyway, you need to be an expert in the domain that you're using these tools for so you can spot the mistakes.
Yeah.
Like when the next generation, the schools now, and we have anecdata on this already, when they start to over-rely on the tools as answer machines, they won't be able to spot the mistakes.
No.
And then what? So you never develop the expertise to begin with.
But one of the things that like I use in my work is a theory called diffusions of innovation. I don't know if you've heard of it, but basically it's like if you look at a bell curve, early adopters, mid adopters and late adopters. And I guess when I think about things like artificial intelligence and some of the tools that we have at our disposal, I wouldn't say I'm like a super early adopter, but I'm probably in the next one. But who's going to get left behind if they never adopt intentionally engaging with artificial intelligence? Because I know we've talked about how some of it is like behind the scenes. And so I kind of wonder about that. Like, are they going to get left behind?
Well, the idealist in me says that nobody should be left behind for, you know, whatever decisions they make on engaging or not engaging with a particular technology.
Yeah.
So, you know, we shouldn't force anybody to use AI if they don't want to. And there are like, people have lots of valid ethical reasons to not engage with AI. So, you know, some are worried about the energy impacts on, you know, the energy use or the water resultant water use, although the water use is a little bit more complicated. Some are worried that their own skills will degrade, which is a completely valid concern. So we know from many waves of automation before that when you have a pretty good automated system, people will over-rely on the pretty good automated system to the detriment of their own skills, so their skills degrade, right? So, you know, that's a valid concern. Others are, you know, don't want to be complicit in this replacing humans movement and so on and so on. So there are many valid ethical reasons for not using or not engaging AI on. So I don't want to force it on anyone. I don't know how you define being left behind. What does left behind look like? Is it unemployed or, you know, what does it look like? But I'm hopeful that eventually we will get to a place that where we don't need to worry about these things.
Yeah.
We don't need to force anybody to adopt things. There are many popular phrases about AI. So probably the most popular one is like, AI is not going to take your job, but somebody using AI will. I'm like, simplistic. I mean, it's a catchy phrase
that
many people buy into. I don't think it's quite that simple.
I guess, like, if I think about computers or if I think about mobile phones, for example, I know there are some people, and because I work with older people, who never set up email addresses, for example, or never, like, really learned how to use a computer. And then telehealth happens, or COVID happens, and telehealth is the only way they can see their doctor. So in my mind, I'm like, okay, they are being left behind of this digital kind of transformation that's happening in our society. And I just wonder, in 20 years' time, 30 years' time, God, who knows what the world is going to look like. But will artificial intelligence have a whole group of people who hadn't engaged with it intentionally then being stuck because what they've got at their fingertips or how the rest of the organizations and the society has moved is relying on it so much that they may not be able to then get the services they need or get the help that they need at whatever point?
So potentially, but I think that's if and, you know, to put a pessimistic hat on, when that happens, you know, it's a systems problem, not a problem for the individual.
Yeah, so we have to think about it.
We have to think about it. Like, we have to provide options for people who don't want to be forced onto, you know, apps or any other systems or whatever.
I think it's such a timely conversation to be having because I feel like we're moving that way in the Western world, that we're becoming so reliant on this kind of...
I mean, a whole lot of it is driven by the efficiency mindset.
Yeah.
And right now, you know, our cousins across the pond are really driving efficiency into government as well. And what few people think is, like, inefficiency is sometimes a very deliberate and useful approach. And there is such a thing as too much efficiency. I mean, we kind of saw that during the pandemic and supply chains. You know, a little bit of glitch and everything just falls to pieces and we don't even have toilet paper.
Yeah.
But
great example.
We don't think about that.
Yeah.
We just have this mindset that more efficiency is better. But at some point, more efficiency creates brittle systems that just break when something goes wrong.
So true.
With so much efficiency, do we lose some of our humanity, do you think?
Probably.
I think so.
Yeah. And we lose kind of features and skills all throughout humanity. And 100 years ago or 200 years ago, humans had a very different skill set to today. Few of us know how to grow our own food anymore.
No.
Nobody knows how to make our own shoes. And you know, broadly speaking, that's been fine. You know, that's how specialization has kind of progressed. That's how we've got into the modern civilization we have. And then we have other kind of tools. We have GPS navigation systems, which results in few people knowing how to read maps anymore. Mm. They're just being guided automatically.
Or know how to draw a map.
To draw a map, yeah. And, you know, these kind of skills, we haven't really stopped and think, like, well, what are the skills that we should still retain and what should we replace them with?
Is it skills or is it also about, like, what critical thinking lens do we need to apply to anything? Because, like, I'm just thinking, say, GPS, right, which I do rely on quite a lot. But I always, like, look at the direction, like, look at the map before I start. I kind of try and sense make, are we going, is it taking me on a logical pathway? Where is that? What is that road? Is that a gravel road, actually? Mm. Like, is that a road that when I hit driving on that at 8 o'clock at night in rural areas where there's animals on the road, probably not the safest option. I might want to take a different route. Like, so the critical thinking that comes into, like, interrogating what might be shown up to us, I think, is a skill that we need to make sure people employ.
Absolutely. And in your example, you need to have a knowledge of the world as well. Because if you don't pay any attention, well, you don't know whether that road is a gravel road or whether that road takes you through a rural patch swarming with kangaroos or whatever.
Happens on a regular basis. I have been led down roads where I'm like, ooh, back up.
And, you know, this is where we also get to cases where they have, like, literal signs on the side of the road that, hey, your GPS is wrong. This is a no-through road and things
yes,
like that.
Yes. Oh, my gosh. That's so true.
But yeah. But because most of the time they work fine, then people kind of start over-relying on them.
I just think, you know, both Fiona and I have insulin pumps. And the thing that I've been told heaps, trust the technology. Just trust the technology. Yes, you might, you know, check the technology, but overall, trust the technology. That's what it's there for. You know, don't fiddle around with the algorithms because I sometimes, you know, override things and mess things up. But I just wonder how much of that message will go to everything. Like, trust the technology, that we don't then critique the technology, or we don't critique what's happening and, as you say, understand the world enough to go, that doesn't look quite right.
So we have both situations. Like, you know, I would feel deeply uncomfortable trying to hack my own insulin pump, but
heaps of people did. Dark underworld did it.
But I mean, we have lots of studies on this as well. So for the majority of the cases, we kind of over rely on the technology. So we trust the technology too much. But there are cases where we trust it too little as well.
Yeah.
So there was a recent study in the medical domain that comparing doctors' diagnostics or clinicians' diagnostic skills versus AI, and, you know, a combination of them, the doctor AI team actually did worse than the pure AI because they didn't trust the AI enough. So when the AI disagreed with them with the correct diagnosis, they were like, well, I know better than the AI. I'm going to go with this instead.
That's fascinating.
And this is, of course, like highly contextually dependent. In many cases, we should trust ourselves more. In other cases, we should trust the AI more. But whatever that kind of, whenever there's a mismatch, that's when we get problems. Like, we think that we know best when we don't, or we think that the AI knows best when it doesn't. I mean, those are problematic situations.
Because you have to think about, the AI brings no personality to it, no, unlike, you know, thinking about a medico, because I'm in that industry, sometimes they know everything, you know, they might not necessarily know everything.
Yeah.
So it's hard to give up that.
And this is such a fast-moving space that it's hard to know what the landscape looks like right now, because you have lots of studies coming out. But even for a high-performing research team, from, you know, the availability of a capability to even having a preprint article out, you know, it's like 6 to 12 months.
Yes.
And in 6 to 12 months, you'll have like two generations of AI models. So whatever comes out now that says something talks about the previous generation of models.
Oh, my God.
That's how quick it's moving. Vertical.
Like, on the engagement side, like, should people engage? Like, how do we deal with this? How do we think about this, right? I mean, I would still advocate everybody to engage with these technologies in their own domain of expertise. And don't start it from a place of, oh my God, this thing is going to take my job.
Yeah.
Because probably not in the short term anyway, but it will be useful for you. And then when you kind of get comfortable with using it in your domain, then, you know, you can get a lot of benefit out of them, and you get more comfort and, you know, a sense of agency when you realize that, hey, actually there are quite a lot of these things that I do that it doesn't know how to do yet, but I can still use it as a useful intern.
Let me
provide a little bit of an asterisk to that. So I completely understand people who don't want to use any of these tools either. I mean, there was a lot of talk about, you know, how wasteful the systems are in terms of energy use and, you know, resultant water use and things like that. And it is a pretty incredible point in history when we have, like, literally three giant technology companies building actual nuclear power plants to power these tools.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
And we're looking at hundreds of billions of dollars of investment into data centers. So do they have, like, actual material consequences for the planet? Yes. Does it mean that we should not use them at all? No. Maybe we should be a little bit more mindful of what to use them for, and maybe not use ChatGPT to ask, like, how many R's are there in strawberry, and then laugh at it when it gets it wrong.
Yeah.
I was like, what's the value in that? Use it for something that it's valuable for.
And it's actually going to make your job or your life easier.
Hi, Fiona here. Thanks for taking the time to listen to the XYZ Experiment podcast. And don't forget to leave a rating and review. If you enjoyed our show, tell all your friends and family and subscribe. Follow us on Instagram at the XYZ Experiment for all the latest updates and news. Our original music was composed and performed by Luke Champion.